Okay, so welcome back. Another sitter discussion. In fact, it's more of a sitter class, isn't it? Because you have to just listen, but hopefully you can engage with it internally and find some practical tips as well as instructions in these sitters. So I was very privileged yesterday to be able to speak to Ajahn Brahm about his translation of the Anapanasati Sutta that is found in the Word of the Buddha book. This is the one that we sent to you before the retreat. This is actually the printed version, but you have a version in your course material, your retreat material. And if you want to look at that as we go through, it is on page 71. And most of what I'm going to be reading is from the Majjhima Nikaya Anapanasati Sutta, which is number 118. And sometimes I'll be referring to that sutta too, because the translation, as I said, is a bit different. And we might see how Ajahn Brahm's changed it slightly and what some of the insights into that translation are. Because what I noticed yesterday when reading it through with him is that he's made it much more of an emphasis, not on the breath, but on the awareness or the learning to experience or the PT, etc. There's just a different language that's used, which is less, it involves less doing. I think the point is that the agent of oneself is less obvious in the way he's translated it. So that's a very interesting perspective to take, which can help us to get out of the way and allow a natural process to happen. So I'm going to begin with the passage on mindfulness of breathing, which is actually on the second page or even the third page of the Anapanasati Sutta in Majjhima number 118, which is page 71 of the Word of the Buddha. And there's a little bit that's missing, so I'll refer back to the 118 for that. So don't worry too much. I'll just kind of go between the two, but just so that you know that it's not all in one place. So here we go. And the little title of the excerpt here in the Word of the Buddha is Nibbana through Anapanasati Sutta, or through Anapanasati. So Anapanasati means mindfulness of breathing. And Nibbana through Anapanasati Sutta. So we can go all the way to Nibbana through observing the breath. And the fact is, yes. And this was the Buddha's own preferred method that he practiced sitting under that Bodhi tree at the age of 35 after 6 years of austerity. And finally, having eaten something soft, something delicious, he was in a position to really relax and to make those last breakthroughs into full enlightenment. So here we go. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it completes the four focuses of mindfulness. And that is the four satipatthanas. So straight away, you might notice, if you're acquainted with the Buddha's teachings, that normally the satipatthana is called the four foundations of mindfulness. But here, Ajahn Brahm's retranslated it as the four focuses of mindfulness, which is significant already, because mindfulness has already been established through previous steps in the path before we even come to breath meditation. So breath meditation, in a sense, is deepening the last factor of the Eightfold Path, which is Sammasamadhi. And before Sammasamadhi, we've already practiced Sammasati. So mindfulness is there. It's not that we're establishing mindfulness with the breath. There's already a preliminary kind of mindfulness that we can direct onto the breath at this stage. When the four focuses of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they complete the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they complete true knowledge and deliverance, enlightenment. So I'll just quickly explain what those seven enlightenment factors are, just their names. So the first one is mindfulness. Again, we have to have that in the beginning, and we develop that further through the breath meditation. The second one is Dhamma Vichaya, which Ajahn Brahm has translated as exploring the Dhamma with wisdom. The third one is energy. The fourth one is joy or piti. I prefer the word rapture for piti. Here he's translated it as unworldly joy, but you could also translate it as unworldly rapture. So the rapture that is born of the mind, not born of sensuality. And then the fifth enlightenment factor is tranquility, pasadi. Oh, sorry, no, the sixth. And then the seventh is equanimity, upeka. So they're the seven enlightenment factors. Together they complete true knowledge and deliverance, enlightenment. So I'm going back now to the Majjhima Nikaya, because there's a little paragraph that Ajahn Brahm has left out here. So here we go. And how, monastics, is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated? How does it complete the four focuses of mindfulness? Or how is it cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a person gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, set their body erect, and established mindfulness as a priority. So Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is in front of one, but as a priority makes a lot more sense here. We establish mindfulness first of all. And then mindfully one breathes in, mindfully one breathes out. So this is missing from the word of the Buddha. I think Ajahn might have put it in another section of the word of the Buddha. But it's very important because this is what we initially do before we actually start watching the breath. So we first of all find a quiet place. So here the example is going to a forest, the root of a tree, or an empty hut. And this is what we've done by being on this retreat. You're in, hopefully, a room. And if there is someone else in the room, it's either your dog, your cat, or another meditator. Hopefully nobody else who can create a lot of disturbance for you. So you have a sense of seclusion. You have a sense of being aloof from the world, separated from the world of busyness. And then we sit down, having folded our legs crosswise with the body erect, which basically means a posture that's comfortable and alert. And of course, in India, in ancient India as well as today, sitting cross-legged was a very comfortable position that most people have been sitting in since the time they were really small. And I lived in that culture. You even go to the toilet squatting, so your hip joints are very flexible, and it's just extremely comfortable and natural to sit cross-legged. It also gives you a firm base so that you're almost like a tripod. You know, you're very steady, very rooted on the ground, and you can remain in that posture for a long period of time. However, if that's not the case for us, because we've not been brought up that way and we haven't got very flexible hips, then sitting on a chair is perfectly good. And you may have read the story about the Buddha's awakening, again, having practiced austerities for 6 years and tortured and tormented the body to the point where he was just skin and bones. The first thing he did after eating the rice milk that Sujata offered to him, a lay woman who had been watching this aesthetic and, you know, wanting to offer him something, the next thing he did was to get some grass and to go and put that grass under the Bodhi tree and make himself a soft and padded seat. So I don't imagine many of you will be going outside now to collect some grass, but you might be grabbing another pillow or getting a little bit more relaxed where you are, because the whole point of this is so that you can let go of the body, not so that you can be in pain with the body. It's anapana, not anapana, as Ajahn Brahm loves to say. So I don't know if that's funny or not. It's a bit corny. But anyway, he asked me to remember that and tell you it's anapana sati, not anapana sati. So this is for your comfort and ease, for your great benefit and great fruit leading to nibbana. So we fold our legs or we sit in any comfortable posture and establish mindfulness before we start to notice the breath. So there's already a sense of mindfulness present, and that's what we've been doing by this present moment awareness. Sometimes the metta practice helps establish mindfulness. It helps establish something even better than mindfulness, which is kindfulness. So I would actually love this to say, having established kindfulness, one breathes in, one breathes out. And I think that would be a really wonderful translation, because again, if you go through the Eightfold Noble Path, you'll find that loving kindness is already mentioned in the second factor, long before we establish mindfulness. So the mindfulness should be infused with this very beautiful, soft, allowing, kind and friendly attitude, friendly kind of tone, if you wish. So then we get on to the breathing. And again, it's quite a different translation. In the Majjhima Nikaya, it says, breathing in long, one understands I breathe in long. Breathing out long, one understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, one understands I breathe in short. Breathing out short, one understands I breathe out short. So the person, the sense of self, is very much present, I feel, in this translation. Listen now to Ajahn Brahm's version. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, and you are aware that they're long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, and you're aware that they are short. That's the first two stages. When you learn to experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. When you learn to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. On those occasions, you're mindful of the body. Having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. So this is a little bit different too, because here Ajahn Brahm is actually putting part of the next section on the four foundations of mindfulness after each and every tetrad to explain how the first tetrad basically completes the first of the satipatthanas, which is the body contemplation. And in both translations, it's made clear that the breath is actually a body in the category of bodies. So body here doesn't mean the physical body, it means the body of the breath. Just like we can have a body of evidence or a body of water, we can also have the body of a breath. It just means a group of things, a category. And that's right here in the sutta as well. So on those occasions, one is mindful of the body, having restrained the five hindrances. And this is Vinaya Loke Abhijja Domanasa, often translated as having restrained or overcome covetousness and grief for the world. And after a lot of studies, Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Brahmali found that the Pali idiom is such that when we say two in a group of things, such as five hindrances, we say the first two. So in this case, the first two hindrances, it means all five. And covetousness and grief is actually a translation for abhijja domanasam, which are synonyms for craving and aversion, which makes so much more sense, because I don't know about you, but I've never really felt covetousness for the world. Am I jealous of the world? What does it mean? And what is the world? The world, when the Buddha talks about the world, he basically means the world of the five senses, right? So craving for sensuality and aversion for anything in the realm of sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So the first of those two. And if we can restrain the first of those two, then naturally the others are restrained as well. The next word here is, he's translated as energized. That's artapi, which is often translated as ardent. But ardent, I think artapi means something like burning up. Like in the Buddha's day, tapas was to do austerities, and it meant something that burns up the defilements, something kind of like fire. So energy is a good translation. So one has energy in the mind because you've started restraining those five hindrances as a prerequisite to this practice of watching the breath. And then fully aware of the purpose and mindful, that's sati sampajanya. So not only are we aware of what we're doing, but we're aware of the purpose of what we're doing, in this case, to actually overcome the five hindrances completely and enter deep states of samadhi. This is the purpose of breath meditation. So the sati that we've developed has already restrained the five hindrances, and now we're trying to knock them on the head completely and move beyond the realm of those five hindrances so that we can immerse ourselves in deep meditation. And then it goes further. In and out breathing is regarded, it says here, by the Buddha as a body in the category bodies. And I'm not sure why it's translated this way. I actually prefer the way it's translated in the Majjhima Nikaya, because the Buddha actually says, I say. And he doesn't say it. Okay. I say that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in and out breathing. So the Buddha is declaring this himself. It's not in the second person here. The Buddha actually says, I say that this in-breathing and out-breathing, is a certain body among the bodies. So the first one was being aware that the breath is long. The second one being aware when it's short. The third one being aware of the whole of the breath, not the whole of the body. Okay? So the breath is one of the bodies in the body. And the last one, learning to calm the breath as you breathe in and out. So it's a process. And it's a process that happens naturally. This is very important. So in the very beginning here, we're not trying to control the breath. You know, just as Ajahn Brahm was saying in his lovely guided meditation, the breath is just there. And our job is to have enough mindfulness to, in a sense, meet that breath where it is, as it is, without actually changing the breath or manipulating the breath in any way, which is, of course, very difficult, because as soon as we become aware, we generally tend to find it becomes slightly more coarse. But the more we can just sit back and allow the process to unfold, the more passive an observer we can become, the more the breath has the opportunity to just calm down. And there are different ways to help us with this. You know, if it becomes really difficult for you to watch the breath, or let's say be with the breath, even the idea of watching it is a little bit too active for my liking. I'd rather not say watch it, but actually be aware. And that's the translation here. Pajanati, it actually means to know. It doesn't mean to watch or to be aware. It means to know. So as we breathe in long, as we breathe out, in or out long, as we breathe in or out short, as we experience the whole of the breath, we just know. And for me, that's even more powerful than experience or be aware of, because if we really want to take breath meditation into deep samadhi, we need to be aware of the breath in a very simple way. Just knowing that we're breathing in or out, not necessarily getting into the details of the touch of the breath. Of course, we're aware of the breath because we can feel it. But if we overemphasize the feeling, then sometimes we can move into a more of a vipassana kind of knowing. In other words, we start to analyze it, we start to explore it in detail. And to move towards samadhi, we need to have a very simple awareness of the breath, which is more like the breath as a concept, right? So the breath as a concept, as opposed to the breath as a something more close to reality, which would be maybe vibrations or sensations of the breath. So we just know this idea of breath. So for me personally, this has been very helpful to shift my practice from a more insight way of looking to a more samadhi way of looking, and allow that breath to become more and more consistent and stable and smooth. So just knowing that you're breathing in or out is enough. So how do we do this if the mindfulness is not strong enough? And I think we've talked many times about ways to establish mindfulness in the beginning, such as present moment awareness, or maybe energizing the mind with reflections that really inspire you, such as reflections on metta meditation, on metta, loving kindness as a quality. Somebody in this group loves the practice of mudita. I don't know if you're here now or not, but mudita can be a great way to arouse energy and inspiration, especially if you're not finding a lot to be happy about in your own life right now. You can find things that are beautiful in the world to rejoice in. You know, the goodness of others, the nobility of others, the fact that there are so many people who will put themselves in really difficult situations, even at the risk of their lives, to serve others. I remember reading about a doctor in Palestine who basically was working in a hospital where the funds were running out. There was very little medical equipment. And People were dying all around him. I'm sure this is still happening now. And he basically said, as long as there are people who need us, we're not leaving from this place. Knowing very well that the next, you know, bomb or bullet could land on him, and that would be the end of his life. This is incredible. This really is something that's maybe, you know, not so easy to have mudita for when we think about the situation there, but to have mudita that there is such goodness in this world, you know, that really contrasts with the horrific amount of suffering that beings cause one another through delusion. So whatever works for you, but if you are already with the breath and you want to stay with the breath, but the mind is just drifting from time to time, then there are other methods too, such as counting. And even Ajahn Brahm was practicing this in the very beginning of his meditation and got great results. The way that he did it, it was with the Samatha Society in the UK. His teacher was Nai Boonman, actually a Thai layman. And he had them to count the breath from, I think, 1 to 9, the first round. Okay, so in, out, one, in, out, two. Or if you want, in one, out one, in two, out two, up to 9. And then in one, out one, in two, out two, up to 8, up to 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then back up again from 1 to 2, in one, out one, in two, out two, in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, out three, in one, out one, in two, out two, in one, out three, in one, out four, up to 9. And if you make a mistake, if you lose it, then you go back to the beginning again. So I think if you do a full round of this, it's about 45 breaths or something. And it all sounds very mathematical. And I'm sure that that appealed to the young Ajahn Brahm's mind. Actually, he was Peter Betts at that time, still a layman. But he got into some very, very deep meditation this way. And so be careful, because it can be a little bit too forceful. And later on in his teachings, he emphasizes doing much less than that. But I have tried this occasionally on retreat and just done a very, very light counting. Like for me, it's better to do it at the end of the out-breath. So like in one, out one, and then a very gentle one, just as the breath disappears. It's like a millisecond before the next breath comes in. And the trick is to emphasize the breath and not the counting, because otherwise what you'll do is just be counting and your breath has gone far, far away and all you're doing is getting your numbers in a mess. So please use this carefully if you choose to do so, but a little bit of gentle counting in the very beginning can be effective. And I found that it helped me to maintain continuity with the breath to the point that there was a lot of bliss coming up. And then I could drop the counting and just let the process continue from there. Another way you may like to try is through using some kind of word or mantra. So one of Ajahn Brahm's favorites is to breathe in health, especially if you're unwell, and to breathe out, let go. Let go of whatever sickness is in your body, whatever toxins are in your body, whatever pain might be there. Similarly, you can just use perception, as we did in the guided meditation, just the perception, you know, that you're taking in oxygen as a gift from nature and giving it back out as a gift. Or you can even bring in qualities such as love and peace. One of Ajahn Brahm's other favorite methods is just to gently use the word calm, 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 occasionally, especially if you find that there's just habitual kind of tension. Or a little bit too much holding, or even maybe excitement is coming into the practice. So you can just say to yourself very gently, calm, calm, calm. And that can give the mind enough of a pointer to actually follow the meaning of that word and just settle down a little bit more. But basically, these first stages are very natural. So you're aware of the, you know, incoming and outgoing breath, whether it's long or short in the beginning, just to have something to capture your mindfulness, just to have something to make it a little bit interesting. But after a while, it doesn't really matter whether it's coming in or out. You're aware of the whole breath. So this is like, instead of counting sort of 1, 2 with the in and out, it's as though the mindfulness touches the breath throughout that one breath. So it's like you're aware, shh, breath. out breath from the start to the end. In Myanmar, where I practiced, my teacher used to say asa ale aso in Burmese, which meant beginning, middle, and end of the breath. So it's as though your mindfulness is making contact with more and more of the breath. And at this point, when you are aware of the whole breath in a really smooth way, the breath starts to feel almost timeless. You actually lose the perception of whether it's coming in or going out, and it becomes very, very smooth. And this is the point where it starts to calm. It starts to settle down and become so subtle that sometimes it's just a feeling that you're breathing, but it's not a very defined breath. It's just breathiness, if you like. I don't know if this is making sense, but hopefully it does. Okay, so that is the first tetrad. And that completes mindfulness of the body. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because in the Satipatthana Sutta, when it talks about mindfulness of the body, it also talks about the corpse meditation and the body decomposing after death and all kinds of other practices. But here, the Buddha's only talking about this pleasant practice of breath meditation. And whilst it can be really helpful to practice other kinds of meditation, this alone is enough. You don't have to do every method. If mindfulness of breathing works for you, great, just carry on. So we'll go to the second tetrad. And again, I'm using Ajahn Brown's translation from the word of the Buddha. When you learn to experience joy, piti, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to experience pleasure, sukha, as you breathe in and out. When you learn to experience the mental formation, that's citta sankhara, and that means piti sukha as known by the mind. So the mental formation of that same piti sukha as you breathe in and out. And what this means here is that the piti and the sukha, which you initially experience more in the realm of the body, you might feel that your body starts to feel very, very pleasant. You feel a sense of rapture that's going through the body. And there are different kinds of rapture that are discussed in the Visuddhimagga, such as, I don't know all the Pali words, but there's a kind of piti that is like a showering kind of feeling. Or there's piti that's uplifting, so you feel kind of light and elevated. I guess this is when people can actually feel that they are levitating, and I don't know, hopefully not going over prison walls, but I don't know, maybe you go through the ceiling or something, hopefully. But it's the feeling, you know, that you're floating, you're feeling very, very light. Or it can be kind of like a sudden sort of flash. I sometimes get this like a sudden flash across the head. It's as though one part of the head starts to just dissolve. Or it can be pervasive. It can be throughout the body and mind. It can be intense. It can be subtle. It can be quiet. It can be extremely blissful. So there are all different kinds of piti and sukha, and at this point they usually arise together. It's not possible to differentiate the two. We're not yet in jhanas. This is only the experiences of the jhana factors, but not the jhanas themselves. We actually need all the jhana factors to constitute first jhana. So not only piti and sukha, but also vitakka and vichara, which is like the mind moving onto the breath and staying with the breath. As I explained with the in and out breathing, you notice it and then you start to stay with it. So vitakka is like that, knowing the in breath and then knowing the out breath. You just know maybe a point of the breath. And vichara is like when you're with it for longer. I think another example they give in the Visuddhimagga is that vitakka is like the initial striking of the gong and vichara is like the ringing. You see how it continues, it continues, it continues. So when it comes to the breath, you're aware, vitakka and vichara, you sustain that awareness. And then the last jhana factor that has to be there for it to constitute a jhana is this ekagata, which can mean one-pointedness or one peak of mind. And that really means that the breath and the mind are becoming completely unified. So there's no differentiation between the object and the observed. It's an experience of complete unification of the mind and its object. So there's no sense of the knower or the doer anymore. There's just one experience in that state. But we're not there yet. Now we're just on the piti sukha, and calming that piti sukha down is the next stage. So yeah, from feeling the piti and sukha in the body, we learn to experience the mental formation of that piti and sukha. So basically this means, again, it happens naturally, but it means that the piti and sukha is starting to become more and more known through the mind. So it becomes a mental object. We're starting to lose the body. The body's starting to fade into the background. And even the breath is starting to fade into the background. So whilst we are still breathing in and out, and the PT is connected to the breathing, the PT has actually arisen through that sustained awareness on the breathing, the breath is not at the front of the mind anymore. The PT is at the front of the mind, and it starts to take over. It starts to become even stronger than the breath. So the breath is kind of in the background, a very, very smooth, very, very quiet, and the PT is building and building and building in the mind. And then the last stage of that second tetrad is learning to calm that mental formation as one breathes in and out. So the PT is strong. It reaches some kind of peak. And sometimes I like to say it's as though we need to become satiated. We need to drink our fill. Because for many of us, especially if we haven't been used to allowing ourselves the joy in meditation, it's a very unfamiliar experience. And we get a bit excited. We might even get a bit nervous or think, oh, this is going too fast, or this is not for me. I don't know if anybody here has ever thought they don't deserve this kind of happiness. Maybe, you know, they should bring up all the things they've done wrong and go back to the beginning. I'm not ready for this. But after a while, you know, when we can allow this piti sukha, it's as though it's very healing. It's very energizing and purifying for the mind. And we just need to soak it in until we've had our fill. And at some point in the meditation, you may find that it becomes a little bit coarse, a little bit agitated for the mind. And the mind just naturally inclines to something much subtler, much calmer than that. So the piti sukha starts to calm all on its own. And we go to another kind of pleasure, which is closer to something like tranquility. So this is the second tetrad. And again, Ajahn Brahm's put in the little section that comes later on in the same Anapanasati Sutta at the end of this tetrad. So it says here, on those occasions, you're mindful of experience, his preferred translation of Vedana, having restrained the five hindrances once again, Vinaya Loke Abhijja Domanasa, energized Atapi, fully aware of the purpose and mindful Sati Sampajanya. So these three aspects come with every tetrad. So atapi, energized, having restrained the five hindrances, and with sati and sampajanya. So these three always have to be there. For being mindful of the pleasure associated with this stage of breath meditation is being mindful of experience. That is why on that occasion, a meditator abides mindful of experience, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. So this is really interesting to me because I've done so much Vipassana practice in the past where we're advised to observe every kind of sensation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and develop a lot of equanimity towards all of those feelings. In other words, to have a response of equanimity, of kind of allowing and acceptance of any sensation, any feeling, no matter what it is, without preference or particularly trying to cultivate one over the other. And this gives incredible results, a lot of stability, a lot of genuine equanimity and ability to face the vicissitudes of life. And yet here in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is practice for samadhi, practice for jhana, no mention of unpleasant sensations is there. No mention of observing painful experience is there. This is a journey through pleasant experience. And my personal feeling is that that's because this is the eighth factor of the path and one already has some ability to work with pain because pain is an inevitable part of life. So I do feel personally that if we only practice with pleasant sensation, we're missing something. We're missing some opportunity to strengthen our equanimity, to strengthen our resilience and our understanding of the impermanent nature of all feelings. So for me, it's very helpful to have had some experience with working with all kinds of feelings in the body and mind, and yet to know that if we are practicing towards jhana, if we are practicing the Anapanasati Sutta, then pleasure can be emphasized and allowed and even cultivated. And this is why we advise people to get comfortable in the beginning. It's not because we want to go around life avoiding discomfort. It's just because we're practicing for the purpose of samadhi. And in samadhi, it's important to develop happiness. And at this stage, we probably have a lot of experience working with all kinds of situations. And now it's time to enjoy the rest of the journey. So I can't really ask you if there are any questions or not yet, but hopefully questions will come later and I can carry on. How are you all doing? Yeah, not too much, not too technical so far. I don't really know, but you look not asleep. So that's very good news. All right. So number three, Tetrad. And by the way, I have to say that this is my own understanding of this sutta, which has been largely elucidated to me and made sense, like in a kind of light bulb way, by my association with Ajahn Brahm over many, many years. And there are very many different interpretations of what these stages mean. And for me, some of the other interpretations are just a little bit confusing and complicated. And when I heard this explanation, it made total sense. So the way that I'm going to describe it now is how I've learned it from Ajahn Brahm. And the third tetrad is basically moving into the territory of the mind. So again, this is actually straight from the sutta itself. But the way he's explaining the mind is starting to see the nimitta, the samadhi nimitta, which is basically the way the mind perceives, we could say, the breath or the piti sukha. But it's a manifestation of the purification of the mind. So, number three, when you learn to experience the citta, and Ajahn has in brackets the nimitta as you breathe in and out. When you learn to brighten the nimitta or bring joy to the citta as you breathe in and out. When you learn to settle the nimitta, still the citta, as you breathe in and out. Citta is mind. And when you learn to enter jhana, liberate the citta, liberate the mind as you breathe in and out. On those occasions, you're mindful of the citta, of the mind, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. I do not say that there is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is dull, who is not fully aware, and in brackets, reaching a jhana with the hindrances gone. That is why on that occasion a meditator abides mindful of the mind, citta, having restrained the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose, and mindful. In other words, mindfulness has come to a peak here. Mindfulness is incredibly empowered, and one is so aware that the hindrances have absolutely gone before entering that jhana. Okay, so once you're in the jhana, there are no hindrances left whatsoever. That's why the mind is liberated. It's not fully enlightened, but it's liberated from the five hindrances. And it's also liberated, as we said in, I think, two sutta classes before, when I was speaking about the Arana Vibhanga Sutta, it's liberated from the five sense world. So not only the five sense pleasures, but the five senses themselves. And that makes a lot of sense because now we're in the realm of the mind. So the Pali for this, learning to experience the citta as you breathe in and out, citta patisamvedi, and then abhipamojayam cittam is bringing joy to the citta. Abhipamojayam, abhipamoja. Pamoja is like pamoja, basically joy. So when we have joy in the mind brightens up. Brightness, joy, energy, they kind of go together. And of course, they are all high energy states. And then, what's that one? Samadaham chittam, when you learn to settle the nimitta or still the chitta. Samadaham chittam, it just literally means stilling the mind. Samadaham is like samadhi. Yeah, it's not concentrating the mind. It's stilling it, you know, just like in all the other tetrads, at the end of each, we're starting to calm something down. So in the same way here, we're starting to calm down the nimitta, still the nimitta. You might have noticed in your own meditation, if you've had some experience of these lights, that when they first arise, they're very jumpy. They might be flashing in the mind. Some people get kind of like, what do you call it? Like fireworks, like explosions in the mind, which are actually quite agitating, very beautiful, but not still at all. And this is when the mind has yet to settle and have confidence in those lights. So here, the brightness is starting to stabilize. And the kind of nimittas that are actually useful and will, in a way, grab your awareness and take over your mind in a very beautiful way. They will envelop the mind, or you will kind of feel that you're being sucked into them, are the kind of nimittas which are very stable and simple and incredibly beautiful as well. So otherworldly, they're not like ordinary lights. They can come in different colors. They can come in incredible intensity. And those details are not so important. The colors and the shapes are not so important as whether they're stable and beautiful and simple as well. One of Ajahn Brahm's little tricks, if the citta or if the nimitta is complicated, and you can get nimittas that are like scenery or even moving kind of nimittas where things are happening, is to focus on the beautiful part of it, on the simple part, yeah? So not to get sucked in by all the kind of diversity, or to give too much importance to or meaning to any particular vision, but just to wait. And I think for me personally, like at this point, if the nimitta is something like landscape or something that's not very steady, I'll just continue to practice with the PT, with the breath, and just settling things down, just staying with the causes that gave rise to those lights in the first place, rather than jumping off to those lights too soon. I think somebody in the questions last night said, you know, if they're going in and out of deep meditation or deepening meditation and restlessness, should they go back again a few steps? I think that was related to that question. And I would actually say there's no harm in staying longer with something, especially at the stage of PT, like really associating that PT with the breath, like understanding that it's that sustained awareness that gives rise to it. It's that awareness that starts to move into the knowing and out of the doing. And the less we do, the more we can watch, the more the energy and the joy starts to arise in the mind. It's like you've cut off the outflowing into the sensual world, into the five senses, and now the joy is just building inside. And eventually that goes into the mind. And when it's really, really strong, the mind brightens up, and the light, or it doesn't have to be a light nimitta. Sometimes it can be a kind of feeling nimitta, or it can be a sense of something like cotton wool or softness, or a kind of feeling that seems to be connected to the body, but is actually different from the body. Just as these things are not actually lights, they're not actually visual, but it's just the way the mind interprets them. But basically, the happiness is coming now from the mind and not from the feelings in the body. So the last one of these four, we've settled the mind. What was that? Samadaham chittam. And then the last one is vimochayam chittam. So that literally means liberate the mind. And the reason Ajahn Brahm's used the word enter jhana here is because vimochayam, or vimochana, is it vimochana? Vimoka. The vimoka as a noun means the jhanas. Wherever vimoka is used in the suttas, it means the jhanas. And vimochayam is like the past participle of vimochati. So vimochati is the verb. Vimochati means to liberate. Vimochayam means the citta has become liberated. So this is really important, actually. I mean, it isn't the grammar lesson, but but it's really important to understand that liberation at this point is not enlightenment. This is the liberation of going into the jhanas. So the mind is liberated from the hindrances, liberated from the sensual world, liberated from the five sense world. And that makes sense of the final tetrad. Wow, we're actually doing 15 minutes for each. This is very good. So the final tetrad, which I will maybe go over a little bit more briefly, is what happens when we come out of the jhana. So here we go. This is the wisdom tetrad. When you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation. So I want to compare this now with the Majjhima Nikaya because it's very different. So in the Majjhima Nikaya, it says, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence, one trains thus. That's Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. So I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence, one trains thus. So here the breath is very much central and the, in a way, intention is a little bit too central, in my opinion, compared to when you learn to explore impermanence in breath meditation. So it's not that the focus here is on breathing in and breathing out. It's just that as a result of meditation on the breath, you're now exploring impermanence and you're using what's just happened with the breath as data to explore that impermanence, to understand that the breath can cease, the breath can disappear. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the breath has usually disappeared around the time that the nimittas arise, perhaps not completely, but when the nimitta becomes really strong, it will kind of subsume the breath. The breath can still be there. It's not as though you've stopped breathing. But the nimitta is so strong that it kind of overpowers the breath. You don't really notice the breath anymore. And here too, we're actually exploring impermanence at this point. And I think the word is anupassi. So anicchanupassi viharati or in it. No, I think it's anicchanupassi asasisami tisikati. So one breathes in with mindfulness of impermanence. Anupassi is something more like contemplation. It's usually translated as contemplation, but explore is a much better translation because contemplation can be intellectual, whereas exploring is something much more direct. It's something you're actually investigating through direct experience. When you learn to explore things fading away in breath meditation, so again, you can explore the fading of the breath, how that happened in retrospect. You can explore what it's like to have had the hindrances fade away. How did that happen from the time the piti arose? What hindrances have faded at that point? When you learn to explore things ceasing in breath meditation, nirodha, nirodha anupassi, asasisami tisikati. So something has actually ceased here. You have direct experience of something ceasing. And this is not Nirodha Samapatti of the Anagami. This is not the state of cessation, but something has actually ceased in breath meditation. One of those things is the breath itself. For the time you are in jhana, the body has ceased in the sense that it ceased from your awareness. It ceased to be part of your awareness. Of course, you still have a body. You still have to come back to the body and the five senses. You still have all the five khandhas. You still have will. But if you've gone into the second jhana, even that will has ceased. In the second jhana, you're literally immovable, like a mountain, like a stone. You're so deep inside that nothing can not easily bring you out unless you go back into the first jhana and then come out of there. And also the hindrances have ceased. And how did that feel? That's why at the end of the meditation, we often say, how did that feel? So that you get into this kind of habit of contemplating or exploring the process of meditation. What happens and how? What are the causes for it to happen? Not only that something happens, but that there are causes for it to fade. There are causes for things to arise and pass away. And there are causes for things to cease. Of course, one of the causes for something to cease is that there is no more fuel at that time. You're not fueling the process. Craving for sensuality has ceased in a jhana, and that's why the sensual world fades away. And then lastly, when you learn to explore relinquishing things in breath meditation, Patinissaga. And the word Patinissaga is straight from the third noble truth, one of the ways of letting go. It means giving up, renouncing, letting go. So you've let go of a lot, but there are also further consequences of experiencing these deep states of meditation. You'll let go of more. The letting go becomes almost addictive. And the more you let go and realize that you're absolutely safe without those things you were clinging to, and actually you feel much freer without them weighing you down, then the more easy it becomes to let go again and again and again. So little by little, we start letting go of the coarser happinesses, and we start to get a taste for these much more subtle and refined happinesses of the mind that are based on sila, that are based on mindfulness, that are based on all these beautiful foundational qualities, such as restraining the five hindrances, energy, metta, loving kindness, and all the other wonderful qualities we develop in our lives. So we're relinquishing, renouncing craving itself. We realize that craving is not the way in. Craving only creates more problems. And of course, one of the dangers with any kind of meditation or any kind of experience we have while we still have very strong tendencies to crave is that we want them back again. We grasp them inappropriately, or we appropriate those states as something that we have. You know, and I always cringe a little bit when people talk about such and such has jhanas or doesn't have jhanas. No one has these things. This is nature. This is just, in a way, it's like one of the realms of existence, the Brahma Loka, you can say. And it's available. It's available to everybody. Sometimes it's just a matter of tuning in. You know, one of my most formative experiences in samadhi practice many years ago was just being with the breath and noticing that it was peaceful, but not really seeing very much to delight in at that time. And then I remembered just a very simple instruction from Ajahn Brahm that said something like, notice bliss or notice peace. I think I still have it on a little stone, a little pebble upstairs that I brought back from Perth, and I wrote it on there in silver pen. I think it was notice peace, because it was peaceful, but it was like nothing special. And as soon as the mind gave itself that instruction, because it had been conditioned to do so, it's like I tuned into a different frequency that was there all the time. And instead of just looking at the things that were kind of a bit ordinary, a bit dull, nothing very special, nothing very painful, it's like there was this deeper layer of happiness underneath. And as soon as I tuned into that, there was another one underneath that, and whoosh, the whole thing just kind of took over. The most incredible bliss arose and lasted for several hours. It was really a very interesting experience. And I'm not making any claims, because monks and nuns are not allowed to claim deep experiences. So I'm not saying this was jhana, but this was definitely strong piti sukha. And it arose through simply noticing the piti sukha that was there, instead of thinking, where is it? I want it. I want this particular experience and not that particular experience. It was something that, you know, I'd kind of overlooked. And that showed me that there was actually nothing to ever worry about, because we're always that close. We're always just a simple change in perception away. Of course, it's hard to repeat these things. You can't think, right, now I know how to do it, I'm going to do that again. Notice, please, okay, where is it? It doesn't work. But it's very instructive in the process of letting go, because we realize that it's not a matter of ability, it's just a matter of the way we perceive. And it's almost like getting a new taste for bliss. So, of course, the reason that this last tetrad is so important and why it's here is because with the foundation of jhana, we now have an opportunity to see things as they really are. And again in the suttas, I think in Sutta Anguttara 1061, and probably, I think it's 1061, Volition, Chaitanya Sutta. There's another one that's very similar, 10.2, I think, Anguttara Nikaya 10.2, which is Avijja Sutta, I think. And both of them are causal sequences. But in the second one, Anguttara 1061, it says very clearly that sila gives rise, basically, for one who has sila, there's no need to make a volition. May I experience joy? It's natural for one with sila to experience joy. That's the word pamoja. Okay, so that's brightening up or giving joy to the citta. For one with joy, it's natural. One doesn't have to will. May I experience piti? It's natural for one who has this wholesome joy from a life of sila to experience piti. For one with piti, it's natural. You don't have to will. May I experience sukha, happiness, bliss, contentment, deep inside. And from sukha, one doesn't have to will. May I enter jhana? May I develop samadhi? It's natural for one with happiness that one experiences samadhi. And then the most important part, for one who experiences samadhi, especially sama samadhi, which means the four jhanas, number one is a sama samadhi, number two is sama samadhi, any one of these, one doesn't have to will, may I see things as they really are. It's natural for one who has experienced samadhi, that they will see things as they truly are. So this is how samadhi gives rise to wisdom. And there's another sutta called the Goldsmith. I think it's in the Anguttara Threes. I might be wrong, but just look it up as the Goldsmith. It's really, I think it's the Goldsmith, or maybe it's the Soil Remover, actually. Both of them are really good, but the Soil Removers, they're both really good. Anyway, in there, it compares the mind after samadhi to being like molten gold. And it says that, you know, when you first get the gold, it has all these impurities in it. So you melt the gold and you remove like the tin and the lead and the copper and all these impurities, which can be seen as removing the five hindrances. And at the end, you have this beautiful gold that is workable, that's soft, that's malleable, and that is fit for work. And really, that is like the mind that's free from hindrances, the mind after samadhi. It's soft, it's malleable, mudu. And another description of that mind is that it's unbiased. It's very fearless at this time. You're so supercharged up with joy and happiness and purity that you're not afraid of anything. So you dare to look in areas that you don't want to look in everyday life. That means you dare to look and see or ask the question, whether there's anyone here, or better, what we take ourselves to be. So we can direct our awareness naturally to the five khandhas, to the six senses. That's seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, and knowing. Yeah, we can direct our awareness to impermanence, to suffering, to non-self, and of course, to fading, ceasing, and relinquishing as well. So this is what can happen after samadhi, and this is the best use of samadhi, not just to bliss out, you know, and stay there thinking that, great, you know, I have something in my spiritual life. This is really not the point. The whole point is to free ourselves from greed, hate, and delusion much more permanently. And you've had a taste of what that's like, at least to be free from the five hindrances in those states. And by being free from the five hindrances, at that time you are not feeding delusion. So the Buddha said that the delusion, the reason that all of us are here, the thing that drives the cycle of rebirth on and on and on, doesn't have a first cause, but it does have nutriments. And those nutriments, the food for delusion, are the five hindrances. So at the time you're in deep samadhi, when the five hindrances are weakened, and this doesn't mean you have to be in samadhi, any amount of restraint of the five hindrances is wonderful. You're starving delusion that little bit. Delusion is being undermined. You're more and more able to see things in a new way, according to the Buddha's own wisdom, according to the way things are. And this is where we need the word of another. We need the word of people who've seen it before. Whether that's your own teachers or whether that's the Buddha himself, it's there in the suttas. He's pointing to this again and again and again. And what I really love about the Anapanasati Sutta is that it's a path of happiness. It's a path of joy. It's a very simple path. And there are causes for the arising of breath meditation that we can put into place. And those causes are which? The previous six factors, or seven factors of the path. Okay. So by practicing Anapanasati Sutta, you're practicing the four focuses of mindfulness. By practicing the four focuses of mindfulness, if that's what you want to do first, you're strengthening the foundations for Anapanasati. Practicing the four foundations of mindfulness is essentially equivalent. There are different methods in the Satipatthana Sutta that might help you. But this is a very beautiful practice, and it's the one that the Buddha emphasized, the meditation on the breath. And that will complete the seven enlightenment factors. So again, being mindful of the body, restraining the five hindrances, energized, fully aware of the purpose and mindful. On that occasion, steady mindfulness is established. On whatever occasion steady mindfulness is established in you, on that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused in you. You develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in you. And this carries on through all seven enlightenment factors. So when we're mindful, we explore the Dhamma with wisdom. On that occasion, the exploration of Dhamma enlightenment factor is aroused, we develop, and by development, it comes to fulfillment. We then arouse unflagging energy, develop it, and bring it to fulfillment. We develop unworldly joy, rapture, piti, develop it and bring it to fulfillment. Then we develop tranquility and bring it to fulfillment. And then we develop samadhi, the stillness enlightenment factor, and finally, equanimity. And in the case of the seven enlightenment factors, my understanding is that that equanimity is the equanimity of the fourth jhana. So we're going through all the jhanas here and developing an incredibly strong mind that can make it easy, let's hope, to end the suffering of birth and death and to realize full enlightenment. So this is how mindfulness of breathing is a great fruit and great benefit when understood properly. And I hope that this was of benefit to everybody here. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Great fruit and benefit means every step, not only at the end of the path, but every step. So just look out for the benefit you're getting and apply it in your lives. Okay, so that ends our afternoon teachings, and we will see you at 6:30 for the silent meditation, chanting without giggles, maybe. We'll see. Maybe it'll be Ajahn's turn today. And then it's funny. He's like always giggling, but if I giggle, then he's very stoic. And anyway, it's quite comical. So we'll see you later on. And I hope you enjoy your break time. Take care.